All right, if you'll take your Bible, I'm excited for us to be able to look together again at 2 Corinthians chapter 5. This was I was planning on just looking at verses 18 through 21 for 1 week, but I realized I had to look at verses 14 and 15, and then I realized, I have to look at verse 16 and 17, so this is getting longer and longer, but it's really, really been an exciting process for me to look at this passage, and a joy for us to be able to spend some time talking about making relationships with other people, to share the gospel and help them follow Jesus, which really should be something that is like the biggest joy in our lives, actually. Evangelism and discipleship should be such a huge joy to us for a lot of different reasons. But if you just think about the gospel to start, what are some reasons it should be a joy to share the gospel with others and help them either know it or apply it? It should be a joy, for one thing, because we get to talk about the most important person in the world when we share the gospel, the most interesting person in the world who we actually have a relationship with. We know him and he knows us. So we're not just talking about a subject, we're talking about a person that we love. And we get to talk about how good he is. We get to say beautiful things about him that are true. We get to talk about the most amazing events that have ever taken place, things that are like way beyond our capacity to come up with. What God did to save us is so wise. We're talking about realities that are profound and mysterious. And as we talk about the gospel, we're reminded of what it means to us, like the impact it made on our lives. Talking about the gospel, we're worshiping, really, which is what we love to do and what we were made to do. And we know it's needed, the gospel. People need to hear the gospel. We're around people and it's sad. There's so many problems, and we know the gospel has the answer to so many problems. We know the gospel has the power to change people's lives in the here and now. We also know it has the power to change them forever. We're talking about hope when we tell people the gospel. We're doing something that we know God loves us to do. We're involved in something that is really significant. I think if you ask God, what are the most important things going on in the world today, they would often have to do with someone sharing the gospel with someone else, someone making disciples. There are a lot of reasons that evangelism and discipleship should be a huge joy for us. But one of the reasons we're talking about this subject is because we know often it isn't. And we know that's true because if it were, we probably would do it more, right? We talk about evangelism and discipleship, relationships where we're telling people about the gospel or helping them apply it, and those aren't always high on our list of things deep down that we're really excited about doing. We know we need to do them, maybe, but not excited. Some, of course, are, praise God, but not all of us, and certainly not all the time. I mean, honestly, when you look at what needs to happen to evangelize or to make disciples, the idea usually sounds great. But we talk one-on-one about changing your life to become more actively involved in evangelism and discipleship, like actually waking up in the morning and doing things differently. And many of us are going to like all of a sudden start talking about how hard it is and have excuses. It will feel like a burden. It's really interesting. Interesting, it's not the best word. Curious, maybe. I don't know. But evangelism and discipleship should be this huge joy for us. We think about what we're doing when we do that. We can all see that, of course. A huge joy. But that's not often how we feel about it. And you kind of wonder why. Like, what is going on? I was thinking about my own life. Discipleship and evangelism, the concept is always a joy. Taking the initiative doesn't always sound quite as fun. And there are reasons I might bring up, especially when I was younger, like I'm a little more shy, or culturally where I come from, the East Coast, you don't really talk to strangers, or, you know, whatever. But those are just excuses at the end of the day, because what is it that makes it seem so hard to take action? I know there are practicalities. I'm busy. I've got all these things going, whatever. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, why does it seem like a burden? Hard. Maybe some of it has to do with the fact that you're putting yourself in a position where you might be rejected, especially when you share the gospel. I always remember when I went out to share the gospel on a college campus when I was a young man, and literally every person I went up to said, no, I don't want to talk to you, almost before I even said anything. I was like, hi. They're like, no. And it's not always that way, of course, but a lot of it is. We're following someone who got crucified. And Jesus was perfect. He explained the gospel perfectly. And he got stripped, nailed to the cross, and publicly executed. So if you like to look smart and wise to people in this world, proclaiming the gospel is not usually the way to do it. If you think about Paul, Paul is way smarter than any of us, hands down. You read his letters in the New Testament, and you're like, what? This guy's amazing. And yet, what did they call him in Athens? A babbler. And that literally meant somebody talking nonsense. It was a put down. And I know some of us, of course, like constitutionally or temperamentally, aren't as bothered by shame as others. Some might be more godly too, but I think many of us are bothered at least a little. We don't like to be shamed. And people are going to shame you, look down on you for telling them about Jesus, for sure, if you are doing it the right way and actually sharing the gospel. I mean, there may be ways you could tell people about Jesus and it won't bother them that much, but you're probably not doing it right if nobody ever is looking at you like, wow, you are a wacko after you talk. And of course, that's like just the lowest level of rejection, really, because people hurt other people for telling them the gospel. People have died for wanting to tell people the gospel, to make disciples. And most of us like feeling safe. And you don't always feel safe when you're making disciples or sharing the gospel. You're kind of putting yourself in a position where you are going to look weak. Maybe because they ask you questions that you don't have the answer to, maybe just the subject matter. But how many of us like looking weak? Not many of us. So there are some things that we could look at that might tempt us to be hesitant or feel like, oh man, I don't want to do this. You know, me putting myself in a position that feels vulnerable to talk to somebody I don't know, that I, like, there's no reason I have to talk to him about this stuff. He's not asking me to talk to him about this stuff. When they could get upset with me or even hurt me for just trying to help them is not something a whole lot of people out there think sounds like a really great, happy way to live. And so we kind of have to figure this out, actually, or we're going to lose heart, be discouraged, which is a problem, because this is literally our mission as a church, why we're on the planet. And because in spite of everything I just said, evangelism and discipleship should be a huge joy for us. It should really be a joyful idea, something that we want to do, or we're just not going to do it, or we're going to do it in a really bad, unhelpful way. So we're looking at someone named the Apostle Paul, who is describing why he wasn't losing heart, why this was something that was really amazing to him, even though he suffered and he was shamed way more than we could almost imagine. If we just take what he says in 2 Corinthians about what he had to go through, the first couple chapters, even before we get to the chapter we're looking at, he says chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, for we were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death. And it seems like some of the Corinthians were questioning Paul's motives as you read the rest of chapter 1, and we know that is hard. Like, there's hardly anything people like less than other people questioning their motives. Chapter 2, he explains why he had to write some difficult stuff to them, and he says, for I wrote you out of much affliction and anguish of heart and with many tears, which sounds really terrible. Imagine writing a letter out of anguish of heart and many tears. He says in chapter 4, he's afflicted in every way, perplexed, persecuted, struck down, always carrying about in his body the death of Jesus. I mean, you know, carrying about in your body the death of Jesus. He says, death is at work in us. His outer self is wasting away. And there's more that we could add to all that if we kept going in 2 Corinthians or looking at the way he describes his ministry other places. Even the next chapter, he talks about afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labor, sleepless nights, hunger. So that's a lot. People literally looking around for rocks that they can throw at you for saying something. Or coming from other cities because they're so mad at you for what you said there, and they want to cause problems for you after they forced you to leave their city, and you did. It's not the kind of life that many people would look at and say makes sense to them. And so Paul's explaining his ministry in 2 Corinthians some, how it actually does make sense, total sense. And the last couple chapters, he's been saying why he's not losing heart, why his ministry is glorious. And we get some insight into why he is so motivated and joyfully lives the way that he does. And of course, you remember last week we saw chapters 4 and 5. There are a couple different explanations, like eternity, judgment. But we're zoning in on a third one, and I think it's a key one, in verses 14 and 15 of chapter 5, and it's love. For the love of Christ controls us. That's the explanation, love. And not just Paul's love for Jesus, but Christ's love. And I don't know if I got it across the way I wanted to last week, that it's Christ's love that he emphasizes here as he's explaining his life. And I'm just bold printing capital letters, love, because that's what has the power to change our perspective on the difficulties that come with evangelizing and discipling. It's like if I describe my last week, my job, just doing my job. And so I'm telling you about doing my job, and I'm like, let's see, how did the week go? Well, I was in prison for a couple days. Then when I got out, I was beaten up. And then, yeah, I was chased by this huge mob for doing what my employer asked me to do. And you said, why would you do that job if it resulted in all that? And I'm like, it's my employer's love that's driving me. And by that, I mean how they love people. That would be strange, I know, at least interesting. We wouldn't be used to that. But still, we know I say that, and I say that smiling, right? Like, that's not something you're complaining about. It's a lot different, me saying I'm motivated by love, than me saying it's my paycheck that's driving me, or my fear of my employer that's driving me, in terms of how I'm perceiving my last week, my attitude, if it's my employer's love that's driving me like that. I don't know, it's hard for me to find a way to say this, actually, that demonstrates how important I think this whole concept is. But we look at a lot of what Paul's doing, and it seems crazy to us. Why does he do it? He's driven by the love of Christ, which of course is different than what's driving many people out there, where they're doing things that are like, whoa, can you believe what this guy is doing? It's usually some lack that they're trying to fill up. Lack of money, lack of approval, lack of peace. There's a lot of lacks that control people to do things that you wouldn't expect them to do. Even professing Christians, you know, will often do things that are really intense. But when you look a little more closely, it's a lack that's driving them. But that's not what's driving Paul. It's not something he lacks that's driving him. It's almost the opposite, actually. It's the overwhelming fullness of Christ's love that's controlling him. And that word control is the key word that we pointed out, too. It's not just motivating him or encouraging him here. It's controlling him, and so it's strong. It's not just like patting him on the back, hey, go, Paul, or like giving him a thumbs up. Good job. It's more like this intense pressure from the outside that's causing him to make certain decisions. The love of Christ is like a prison guard that has handcuffed itself to Paul and is taking him somewhere. Which honestly, I'm praying will happen to us, to me. I want the Spirit of God to help you feel pressure, pressure as you think about evangelism and discipleship. Like, we have to do this. I've been handcuffed, but joyfully, happily, because it's love that you're handcuffed to. It's love that's pressuring us, controlling us, not some lack, like I have to be a good person, or I have to have these people's approval, or some other fill in the blank. It's gotta be the love of Christ that's controlling us like this. But again, it's controlling us. Don't minimize that. There are changes that it's going to produce. And so we started looking at how this is working exactly for Paul, because we all know Christ's love. This isn't like a new concept. But is it controlling us? Like, as you look at last week and when you woke up, is it forcing you to make certain decisions rather than other ones, the love of Christ? It's controlling Paul. And why? That's what we're trying to figure out. Why is it controlling? And why does it have that kind of power in his life? And we saw that he said, for the love of Christ controls us, having concluded. Like, he was looking at something and suddenly something became clear to him. He's controlled because he came to understand something. Or he came to a conclusion about something as he looked at the death of Jesus on the cross, which I think is important to remember. As we look at how we live now as Christians, it flows out of what we came to understand back when we first became Christians. When you became a Christian, you remember this, right? Like, when you became a Christian, you were not just deciding you were going to try to be a nicer person or a better person. You learned about an event in history that actually took place. And hearing what the gospel said that event meant, you decided, yeah, that's true. That is reality. And what exactly did Paul conclude about that event? Do you remember? At least what was at the heart of it? Because it was union with Christ, the connection between Jesus and the believer. One died for all. He says, having concluded this, one died for all, therefore all died. That changed everything. And some of us have read that verse so many times, it seems obvious to us. But there are a lot of things that are not obvious about it. Like one dying for all. Especially given the way he's using the word for, because it means in the place of. It's like we got this man here, literally being crucified, hanging there with nails through his wrist a couple thousand years ago for us. And we came to realize that one man dying there was dying for, representing all these other men. And that's pretty striking, a man dying as a substitute, you could say, for this whole big group of people. But still, we can probably wrap our minds around that, at least a little if we try. We can understand someone dying for what someone else did, though there's a little more to it. But what's maybe more difficult is what he says next about his death, meaning they died too. One died for all, therefore all died. That one's really something unusual to say. I don't know anywhere besides the Bible where you'll hear anything like that, about someone dying in the past, like literally dying, and all these other people who haven't even been born yet, dying with him somehow at that same time. That's different. But for Paul, those two concepts are actually like the Christian life 101. Jesus as substitutionary sacrifice for all and union with Christ, therefore all died. And I think many of us know how important Jesus as substitutionary sacrifice is. Like, if you're sharing the gospel. You realize you don't understand much about the gospel if you don't understand Jesus dying up there on the cross is for your sins. That's how we're forgiven. That's how we have peace with God. That's fundamental. But I wonder if as many of us understand that you're not going to really know much about living the Christian life until you grasp how connected to Jesus you are. Something happened to Jesus up there. He died. And then he was buried. And 3 days later, he rose. And time and time and time and time again. Like seriously, time and time and time again, Paul says, if you're a Christian, somehow, in some way, that happened to you. He died. You died. He rose. You rose. And here he's stressing the fact that God united us to Jesus like that so we could live differently than we did before. He's focusing on the implications. And of course, there's going to be implications. If you really did die, like if that's real, and then you rose, there are going to be implications. And it's real if you're a Christian. It's real. You really did die with Christ. You really did rise with Christ. A death has taken place in your life, and a resurrection has taken place in your life. And that death and resurrection has implications. And what are those implications? The first is a transformation of your entire approach to life. Union with Christ changes your entire approach to life. Paul says, for the love of Christ controls us because we've concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all died, and he died for all. Why? That those who live, and we highlighted that word live, to remember to stress the fact that this is not something negative. Dying to self, we really want it to feel negative for some reason, but it's not negative. We had to die with Christ, yeah, but we were dying to sin's penalty and its power, and that's a good thing. We died to all that so that we could live a whole new, different way now. And Paul starts giving a general sketch of what that looks like. He says that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised, which of course sounds great and also kind of something we would expect Paul to say. But we've got to ask, what does that mean specifically? Because we can see there are these two different controlling principles, self or Christ. And I guess the first is kind of obvious because we all know what it's like to live for self, how that's controlling. I mean, that's even the issue with evangelizing and making disciples, right? Like we might have all these grand ideas about what we think is right to do, but what controls us, you know, in the day-to-day and makes it almost feel impossible to do anything other than what we're already doing or not doing. Self is very controlling when it comes down to it, and the unbeliever is enslaved to that. But we're not. We're not. Christ's love is put on display by the fact that he died in our place so that we might be freed to live, Paul says, for him who died and rose on our behalf. But what does living for him look like? That's the question. And in verse 16, if you look at it, Paul says, from now on, therefore. And therefore tells us that he's going to begin talking about that. It means as a consequence of what I just said, therefore, as a result. And the specific result that he brings up here is not what you would expect. He says, from now on. Which I know at first kind of makes it sound like he's saying from today. Like I just wrote this down and from now on, since I wrote this, we. But of course, that's not what he means from now on. He either means, one, from the point that Christ died and rose again. And so now being after the cross, from now on, after the one died. Or two, from the point when he was converted, now being when he concluded, at that point, having concluded, from now on, we regard no one. And the truth is, it's probably kind of both. Because you ask Paul, and definitely something objectively changed at the cross. There's pre-cross, there's post-cross. It's a turning point in human history. That practically, though, for a while, didn't make a lot of difference in Paul's life. Until he was converted, until he concluded, one died for all, therefore all died. And I think that's probably what he is mainly focused on here, actually. Seeing that Christ died and coming to this conclusion that we have been united to him in that death so that we could stop living for ourselves and live for him. Therefore, from now on, this is the result. We regard no one according to the flesh. Which I don't know about you, but seems kind of surprising to me. Almost anticlimactic, actually. It's just not what I would think Paul would bring up here. When I think about no longer living for self. And the obvious therefore that comes after that, about how we can apply that to our lives, that would explain then why we happily do things like evangelizing and making disciples. I don't know, but what would you say at this point if you were writing this? From now on, therefore, what? Because this is just not where I would have gone. Like, you want to know why I live the way I live? I'm controlled by the love of Christ. I get that. And why am I controlled by the love of Christ? I understand that I'm united to him in his death and resurrection. That I can follow. And that union with Christ then produces a new way to live. It's like, of course it does. And what does that look like? Not for self, but for Christ. Yeah. But get more specific about how that works out. Here it is. Not living for self because I've been united to Christ means I look at people differently than I used to. You talk to Paul about union with Christ. One, union with Christ has changed the way I live. Specifically, two, union with Christ has changed the way I look at people. From now on, we regard no one according to the flesh. But what does that mean, Paul? What does that actually mean? And why is that such a powerful idea for him? Does it have any impact on the way that we live right now? Is it relevant for us too? Those are the questions swirling around in my mind as I look at that. And first of all, of course, we have to understand what the words themselves mean. What does it mean to regard no one? The Greek word for regard is no, technically. So we know no one now. But obviously, Paul can still look at people and see what they look like or what kind of job they have and all that stuff. So it's not like you're talking with Paul about someone you met and you're like, hey, you remember that guy? He had brown hair and he had that really big nose. And Paul says, I'm sorry, I don't know people that way. I don't know who you're talking about. That's not what he means. It has to do with an evaluation instead, the word know. And that's probably why they use the word regard here to translate this, because regard in English can mean to consider and appraise from a particular point of view. And that's what Paul's talking about. The way he evaluates people has changed. And not just the way that he does, because he says we here. So he's talking about all of us as Christians, all of us united to Christ by faith, all of us who have been united to Christ by faith, and he's saying that who we're living for has changed. Therefore, the standard we use to know people, to consider and appraise people has changed, which is why all the sacrifices make sense now and why we go around making disciples and sharing the gospel, and we're so happy about that. I mean, that's a big part of his explanation. But again, how does that work exactly? How does this do that in people? We got to keep pressing into what Paul means here because we see, okay, yeah, he's saying his view of people has changed. But from what? What was the standard he was using before? Because we all have a standard, actually. We're not just going through life looking at people. As we enter into relationships, we're regarding them, evaluating them. And there's something we use to do that. That impacts the way we relate to them, that's connected back to our worldview. And I know at first it might seem like there's a million different ways of evaluating people out there, but ultimately for Paul, you boil them all down and there's really only two. And the first is according to the flesh. That is one standard, the flesh standard. Paul says, from now on, We regard no one according to the flesh. And yet at first, that doesn't sound super helpful, actually, because flesh is kind of a funny word. I say I'm evaluating you according to the flesh. And what do I mean? You got to interpret the word flesh. It's a pretty broad word. So there are a couple different ways you could do that. Like, for one, it could mean my sinful desires. So we no longer evaluate people on the basis of our own sinful desires. And that kind of makes sense. If we're living for self, we're driven by sin, particularly selfishness, and then we're going to be appraising people, whether we know it or not, by how much they please us. Or another option for Paul is that could mean religious rituals, observance of the law, which sounds like a different way to use it, but in Philippians chapter 3, he does. He says, "For we are the circumcision, who worship by the Spirit of God and glory in Christ Jesus and put no confidence in the flesh." And flesh there is the opposite of worshiping by the Spirit and glorying in Christ Jesus. And so flesh and spirit are like opposite ways or worldviews. Flesh is everything people do to earn favor with God, trusting in themselves, their own efforts, all that religious activity. And so if we look back at our lives pre-Jesus and we're living for self and we're pretty proud and we're religious, what we do is we end up using religion to exalt ourselves. And so then we're going to evaluate people how? On the basis of how well they measure up to our standards or don't measure up, basically. Or a third option is that it's just a way of talking about the world system, the way that people are taught to evaluate other people outside of Jesus. As one man says, the ordinary, unreconstructed life where human relationships and practices have not been reordered by Christ. And so look, we know as Christians, Christ came into the world. And that, once you understand that, it changes the way you look at everything. But there's obviously a whole world out there that doesn't understand that and still has a way of thinking and living and feeling and relating to people that hasn't been turned upside down by the Christ event. And we could call that whole system the flesh, which is probably what Paul's getting at here. This category is broad enough to include all three, I think. Knowing someone according to the flesh means to evaluate, appraise, or judge other people's worth based on external standards like status, wealth, heritage, religious performance, appearance, or usefulness to you. Which, of course, is how most of the world works out there. And Paul says that what he came to understand about Christ's death changed all that for him. And when we say change, we're talking about a complete 100% transformation. I mean, I don't know. This is the struggle preaching this because I don't know how revolutionary that idea sounds to you. It feels a little bit like a battle, you know, because this is clearly pretty powerful for Paul. You look at him pre this conclusion and then post this conclusion, and his whole life changed in really dramatic ways as a result of this, which of course is why it makes sense to him to bring it up here as an explanation. And I just have a feeling all week, I've had this feeling that if we could get this the way that Paul's meaning it, it would be revolutionary for us as well. But I think there are some things inside that just make it really difficult for us to see it that way, which is why I read that and we're kind of all nodding our heads. It doesn't seem that dramatic to us at first glance. And I think one problem is that most of us probably don't feel like we judge people according to the flesh. Even most unbelievers don't think they do that anymore. That's a no-go in America, supposedly. One of the reasons why I just wonder if that's true or not, or two of the reasons why I wonder, is because knowing people according to the flesh is a symptom or result here of living for self. No longer living for self in verse 15, and from now on in verse 16 go together, like two opposite sides of a coin. And obviously, living for self is definitely still a problem. So I'm guessing this is still going to be one of the ways it shows up in people's lives, knowing people according to the flesh. And then the other reason why I wonder if it's not a bigger problem for us than we might realize is how difficult it can be for us to evangelize and make disciples, why it doesn't seem joyful. Maybe we're still knowing people according to the flesh more than we think we are. Maybe we haven't quite enjoyed the change that's taken place because of our union with Christ as deeply as we should. So humor me a little. Just humor me. Let's try to enjoy this a little. Humor me first by just thinking, being willing to think about the possibility. Let's just put it out there that there might have been a system that you were brought up on, a way of looking at the world apart from Jesus that didn't really take the way God's saving through Jesus into consideration, that is revealed in how you typically, instinctively regard people, that has had a controlling influence on your life, has literally made decisions for you, which is maybe one reason evangelism and discipleship seem like a burden to you, like not even like options a lot of times. And actually living a life like Paul feels crazy when for Paul, he's like, of course, like I happily do this because he's rejected that old system. He's rejected that old system. I don't know. I wonder if you've ever thought about it like that. Why might I be lacking joy in evangelism? Why might I feel like discipling others is so hard? So many of these commands here. Why might being rejected and treated like you're foolish be so painful that you want to avoid it? Why might I look at someone who seems successful and nice and not feel like they're very needy? And not feel like I have something they absolutely desperately need to hear? Because while I might think it's because of this and this, you know, what if it's actually because you're still living under that old system? You're letting that old system control you. What if, without maybe even realizing it, growing up, your world, your heart, your parents have been catechizing you, discipling you, training you in a system basically about how this world works that hems you in. It's hemmed you in. It's limited your options. Like a lot of stuff that could be options, you don't even see it as options. And it's even impacted, like you want different things than you would want because of this system. It's decided on what you want, what you do, what you pursue. What if? Because I think there is. That's the thing. That's the point. I think there is a system, and it is hard to shake. A whole system of worth and value, a whole way of looking at the world and people that has nothing to do with God and what he did through Jesus or being united to Jesus, that apart from a revolution in your life has kind of decided for you, pre-decided what you should value, what you should not value, what's appropriate for you to do, what's not appropriate for you to do. What's really shameful? What's not shameful? What people need? What people don't? What's a big problem? What's not a problem? What matters in life? What doesn't? Which is why Paul says, from now on, we regard no one according to the flesh. You know, he has to say, from now on, because we used to, but we don't anymore. We rejected that system. In fact, because of union with Christ, we've been set free from that system. And yet if we're not careful, we can still go back and let it control us. Please put the handcuffs back on me. Because really, it's like the air we breathe out there. As we're talking at work, as we're talking to each other, as we're watching entertainment, this system is being pumped into our veins. I mean, we hear it so much, it's like it starts to feel like it makes sense. And that living like Paul is what's really unusual and strange, which of course is why we have to identify why it's such a huge problem a little more precisely. Seeing why it's a huge problem makes you want to keep rejecting it as best as you can. And I think to do that, it helps to think more about what's at the root of it. Like, why do people regard others according to the flesh? Because it's more a natural consequence or a result. You might even say a symptom that reveals the problem. It comes from somewhere, in other words. But where exactly? Because again, I think Paul tells us, if we go back and read verse 15 and 16 together, though he's talking about Christians, so he says it positively, Christ died for all so that those who live might no longer live for themselves. Therefore, from now on, we regard no one according to the flesh. But what if we said it the opposite way, to describe someone who's not a Christian, who's not connected to Christ, and what happened to Christ on the cross? I mean, if you somehow were disconnected from Christ and what happened to Christ on the cross, what do you end up with? You're out there all by yourself, and you're living for yourself. And when you're living for yourself, what that means really is that you are your own God. And I know being your own God seems like the dream to many people. That's what they want. But one of the problems with being your own God is that it means you're going to have to save yourself. And make no mistake, whether you're a believer or unbeliever, as you live your life in this world, you're looking for salvation. You need it. Justification, deliverance, glory, hope, all that stuff. Though you may not define it the way the Bible does, you might give it other names like approval, people thinking I'm good, security, success, an exciting future, something to be confident about. But you're looking for some sort of salvation, and you're going to come up with a plan to get it. If you're not confident that you're getting all that because you're united to Jesus by faith, then you're going to have to try to get it for yourself by what you do. That's the other option. It's Christ or self. And where are you going to learn how to be saved like that? If you're rejecting the Bible's plan and what it says about Christ, if that's not impacting you at a core level, then you're going to learn where to look for salvation from the people around you. And what do people who have not had their worlds truly turned upside down by the grace God has shown through Jesus focus on when they think about how to get approval, security, glory, or something to hope in? They focus on externals primarily. They shrink salvation down to what you can get in this life right now and what you can achieve by yourself. And that means they're always going to end up magnifying, emphasizing what people can see on the outside. That's where they're going to look for approval, for security, for glory. And the particular externals they might emphasize might be different depending on the culture or family you grew up in. But it's externals. And so you look at Paul's life as an example before he became a Christian, and you can see one way that worked out. Because you remember maybe that he took a lot of pride in his heritage, placed a lot of importance on that. He was a Hebrew of Hebrews, he says, of the tribe of Benjamin, of the nation of Israel, circumcised on the eighth day. And also on his personal achievements, too, he's like a religious leader, a Pharisee, and not just any Pharisee, an extremely zealous one. And he's super, super serious about external conformity to God's law, which in and of themselves are not really bad things, actually. That they were for Paul, and they ended up causing him to do a lot of bad things because these weren't just facts about him. They were things he was placing his confidence in, boasting in, what he was using to save himself. And the reason that particular method was so attractive to him was because he wasn't looking to Jesus to save him, and so he was learning how to save himself from the community he grew up in. And since he grew up in a community that was super religious, it was things like being a Pharisee or being known for keeping the law that he was confident could do it. And you know, he's not the only one. That's the thing. The reality is that's pretty much how it works for every single unbeliever out there. Whether or not you grew up in a religious community like Paul, you grew up with people teaching you what to put your confidence in. You grew up with people defining salvation for you. This is what a good person looks like. This is how you can be secure in life. This is what it means to be a success. This is righteousness, in other words. This is deliverance, in other words. This is glory, in other words. And they're telling you how to get it. You've got to do this. Whatever you do, you can't do that. You've got to do this. You can't do that. And whenever people do that, apart from Christ and union with Christ at the center, all that external, outside, how you look kind of stuff, like where you went to school, or what your heritage is, or what your income level is, or what your profession is, or whatever it is your culture defines as righteousness, being a good person, a success, becomes freakishly important. It becomes so insanely important, way more important than it should be. Because look, how did this go to that? It's because that external thing is not just about an external thing anymore. It's about salvation. It's about justification. It's about security. It's about hope and how we achieve that for ourselves. And the thing is, when we're looking to external things like that to save ourselves, it is going to end up controlling us. Put the handcuffs on. It becomes like an operating system that runs in the background, and it shapes how we function. And one thing it shapes for sure is how we regard other people. If we're living as if we had to save ourselves, we are going to regard people according to the flesh. And that has a huge impact on what you do or are willing to do. Because you look at somebody, maybe who looks like they have whatever external thing you're emphasizing, and you're not thinking, man, this guy's really needy. He's really needy. You're going to probably be impressed by them and think they kind of have it made. You might even be intimidated by them. And then people who don't have what you think is so important, you're not going to have a lot of true compassion for them. At best, you're either just not going to care or you're going to pity them. And that's very different than biblical compassion. But usually, it's a lot worse, actually, because usually this whole salvation apart from Christ on your own through what you do system is going to make you very hard on people you don't think measure up. If you think about Paul again, we know what this whole system ended up doing to him and people like him. If we think about the Gospel of Luke and what the Pharisees were like, they weren't seeking the lost. They were persecuting them, which is pretty much what always happens to people who are trying to save themselves, even if they're professing Christians. Read Galatians 4, Paul, he literally says that. But if that's how you know people, if you've bought into that whole system, you're not going to end up with a true heart for people or willing to make sacrifices for people who might bring you pain and shame, who might make your life uncomfortable. Or to say it the other way, I guess, if you're not willing to joyfully make sacrifices, if you don't have a heart for people, if you're not willing to make sacrifices for people who might bring you pain and shame, maybe it's because you've bought into that whole system. Because making sacrifices for people who might bring you pain and shame, that will make no sense if you're driven for approval and you think you get it through your own efforts. That will make no sense if you're looking for a little bit of safety in this world and think you have to get it through what you do. If you're looking for joy and you think you get it in getting what you want right now. If you're hoping for glory and think you get that by other people being amazed by what you did, then an evangelistic ministry, taking the gospel out to people like Paul did and discipleship too, is not going to seem exciting or joyful. And actually, what you'll end up doing if you do it is turning that evangelistic or discipleship ministry into something that's very far from actually gospel-driven kind of evangelistic or ministry. You're going to somehow make it into a way of exalting the flesh. Because a true evangelistic ministry like Paul's, discipleship ministry like Paul's, a lot of times you're going to be shamed for that. A lot of times it's going to be uncomfortable. It's not going to feel safe. And maybe since we're in church and Christians, we might know it's right, but if we're still controlled by that old system, it is going to be so hard to get us to move and make any changes in the actual way we live life. And if that's true of you, as we talk about evangelism and discipleship, I'm just asking you to look back at the love of Christ. Do you understand how cool, how sweet this is? Like, it's not like, oh, I got to call them to be joyful in discipleship, so I got to find some way to like make us all feel. I'm asking you, man, you struggle with joy in evangelism, discipleship. It's the gospel's better. Maybe the gospel's way, way better than you imagine. The love of Christ is so good. We're going to celebrate communion, actually, in a minute. So this is a perfect time to do this. I want you to think about Christ's death. One dying for all, being connected to that. What it means, because it has the power to change you. If you understand what Paul understood, you'll see that it should really turn upside down everything about you for a couple reasons, a lot of reasons. But first of all, because it means God does not save people on the basis of external things. God does not give his great gift of justification, security, glory, adoption, our eternal inheritance on the basis of any external thing in you. One died for all, in the place of all. That's how salvation works. It's on the basis of Christ and what he did. Which obviously, you know what it does then? If that's how God saves, gives the greatest gift in the history of the universe, really the only thing at the end of the day, when it's all done, this is the only thing that where real glory is. This is the only thing that matters. If God doesn't give that gift to anyone on the basis of external things, what does it do? It obviously makes all those external things very, 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 very unimportant. You have it, you don't have it. Who really cares? It's like Confederate money after the Civil War ended. Ooh, you got all that Confederate money. Acting like it had some value. Oh, you imagine some guy after the Civil War, you know, like he's letting his emotions get all worked up about how much of Confederate money he has or doesn't have. Letting your emotions and what you do be attached to getting that or protecting that stuff doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. First of all, just looking at how God saves. But second of all, looking at Jesus, because Jesus himself shows you that whole system is totally nonsense. No matter how often you hear it, no matter what excuses people make for it, that system is what doesn't make sense. Because look at verse 16 again. Paul says, from now on, therefore, we regard no one according to the flesh, even though. And even though means it's like he's going to take a second and give us an example. We don't regard people according to the flesh, even though there was a time, you know. We once regarded Christ according to the flesh. Because obviously we know Paul wasn't always a Christian. And so there was a moment he changed. But before he did, he evaluated Christ according to that old system, just like all the other Pharisees did. And yet, you know what they ended up doing as a result? They ended up crucifying him. You understand? Because here's the most important human who ever lived, the greatest person, the person the Bible's all about, the best person who ever lived, the one God the Father looked at and said, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. And yet they regarded him according to the flesh, and he didn't measure up. Which, of course, means that whole system is broken. You got to throw it out. If Jesus doesn't measure up to that system, you got to throw it out. You can't let that standard control you anymore if you're a Christian. Because Paul says, even though we once regarded Christ according to the flesh, we regard him thus no longer. His whole view of Christ changed. And the moment it did, everything else changed for him. And it was like Christ and what he did and his connection to Christ created this whole new system for Paul. And it should for us, where we stop looking at our lives and other people according to the flesh. And now you know how we look at them? According to Christ. According to Christ. And when we look at Christ in the Gospels, how did he view undeserving, obnoxious, needy, time-sucking, difficult people who would bring him nothing but really shame? He pursued them. Obviously, the tax collectors and the sinners, but even Jerusalem, even those self-righteous religious leaders who were going to crucify him, what did he do as he was entering Jerusalem? What did he do? He wept over them. And if that's how Jesus viewed them, and if Paul says here that Christ died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but live for him who died and rose again on their behalf. I'm just convinced if God helps us really believe that, if that starts becoming our core operating system, how we look at the world, how we look at people, evangelism and discipleship is going to become more and more a true joy for us, like it did for the Apostle Paul. Because as undeserving people being loved by Christ and united to Christ, we get to be instruments in Christ's hands to show this great love to other people.